provided by Thomas Allgaier and Frenes, based on the most relevant posts on LinkedIn about private equity in CW3233. Frenes is a B2B market research company working with enterprises to optimize their campaigns with account and executive insights far beyond AI. Welcome to the Deep Dive. This is your shortcut to getting really well informed on the latest in private equity. We're here to, you know, cut through all the noise and pull out the most crucial insights.
Exactly. It's all distilled from curated LinkedIn content, specifically from calendar weeks 32 and 33. We've done the homework for you.
Our goal today, to really unpack what's shifting in the PE landscape. We're going to zero in on the top trends, the key themes that are shaping the industry right now.
Yeah, it's about getting to the core of where PE is headed. So let's jump right in.
Okay, first big theme, AI and data in private equity, this whole area of strategic deployment and impact. What's really interesting is how AI seems to be moving past the hype. You know, it started to show some actual tangible results.
It really is a significant shift. Sol Rashidi pointed out that AI adoption is kind of showing different operating philosophies between PE firms and, say, Fortune 500 companies.
Oh, interesting. How so?
Well, both are finding success, but their execution is different. PE firms seem to be pivoting away from those riskier AI-first type ventures.
Right, the ones that might take ages to turn a profit.
Exactly. They're leaning towards more de-risked, scalable applications that are really tightly aligned with clear, often immediate value theses.
And it's definitely not just a passing fad, is it? I saw Brett Martucci citing that PwC Private Equity Trend Report 2025 shared a pretty striking number.
Which one was that?
A full 62% of PE execs plan to invest in AI-related companies this year. That actually puts AI just slightly ahead of cybersecurity as a top strategic focus.
Wow, 62%. That's huge.
It really shows how AI is blurring those traditional sector lines. It's acting both as, you know, a direct investment theme and a catalyst for adjacent stuff like infrastructure, energy, tech platforms.
That's a really powerful signal. And to help firms navigate this, Matthew Hall has actually developed a new AI maturity model specifically for PE.
Okay, like a roadmap.
Pretty much. Think of it as a clear framework. It helps firms assess where they are with AI right now and then plot a strategic path, you know, from just experimenting all the way to scaled, impactful integration. It gives them a predictable pathway.
A clear roadmap. That's useful. And it sounds like it's paying off already. Jeremy Rosmarin highlighted how AI is streamlining workflows, both on the investment and the operating side.
Yeah.
Which means smaller teams, maybe even just one or two person GPs, can actually execute more with less resource. That's a massive efficiency boost, right?
It truly is. And Regina Penity added to this, talking about how AI is transforming the deals themselves. You've got firms like General Atlantic, Schroeder's Capital. They're actually putting AI on their investment committees now.
Really? Using its analytical power directly in decision making.
Exactly. And then you see Blackstone using document AI to flag contract risks before a deal even closes. But, you know, it's not all plain sailing.
What are the hurdles?
Well, there are still active legal and regulatory questions floating around. Things like fair use, supply chain integrity, aligning with global standards coming out of the EU or China. These are still being worked through as AI gets embedded deeper.
Those regulatory points are definitely key. But focusing on the immediate gains, Michael Weinberger offered some really practical steps for boosting EBITDA using AI-driven process reengineering.
Yes, the four phases.
Right. Assess, aggregate, amplify, and accelerate. It sounds like a very clear, pragmatic pathway to getting some quick operational wins.
It is pragmatic, but, you know, while the promise of tech like cloud migration, AI orchestration, it's huge for faster decisions, smarter valuations. Javier Jimenez rightly pointed out there are still significant hurdles.
Like what? Still the data issues.
Yeah, exactly. We're still dealing with messy, non-standardized data. Plus, there's a real scarcity of talent who know how to actually implement this stuff effectively. And of course, that classic resistance to organizational change.
Always a factor. And maybe that ties into Alexis Sikorsky's hot take. He suggested PE firms are sort of quietly shifting away from those AI-first businesses.
Why is that?
Because of the high risk and those long profit timelines we mentioned, they seem to prefer AI more as an efficiency tool, something to optimize operations, rather than the sole reason for a business's existence. It fits that de-risking trend.
That makes perfect sense. And it really reinforces Sean Anold's point. PE firms need to be using AI now, not just exploring it.
Get practical.
Exactly. He shared some really compelling real-world examples, too. Things like a 40% cut in diligence time, over 100 hours saved per portfolio company on ops reviews, AI spotting red flags 2 weeks earlier than humans could.
Wow.
And even LP reporting Q&A time getting slashed from 3 days down to just 3 hours. These aren't just theories. They're real, tangible, bottom-line impacts.
Those numbers are definitely impressive. And you can see the practical focus gaining traction elsewhere. Mark Rogerson's pre-sale for his book, The AI Fix for Private Equity, and Steve Budd's Bonsai Labs partnering with AI Pathfinder.
Right, helping firms actually deploy AI across their portfolios. And this focus on practical adoption, it's even showing up in community events. Kurt Yang ran a virtual event focused specifically on AI-native family offices and private equity firms of the future.
So everyone's diving deep into the how.
Precisely. It signals a real industry-wide push into practical AI adoption and governance, moving well beyond just talking about it.
Okay, so summing up AI in PE, what's the main takeaway?
I think it's clear the industry's moving past that risky, experimental AI-first phase. The big transformation isn't just about investing in AI companies, but using AI as a powerful operational lever.
Right.
We're seeing it cut costs, streamline processes, enhance decision-making all over the place from diligence right through portfolio management. The question now isn't if firms should integrate AI, but how to do it smartly and strategically, even with those challenges around data and talent still lingering.
Okay, let's shift gears. Our next big theme, value creation and portfolio operations, the new imperative. This feels like a really fundamental shift in PE strategy, moving beyond pure financial engineering.
Absolutely. It's about core operational improvement now. Stefan Pauls put it really well. He argued that with higher interest rates, the old buyout model, the one that relied so heavily on debt for returns well, it's fundamentally changing.
So what's the new focus?
He calls it corporate craftsmanship. Basically, building real, sustainable value by actively growing revenue and improving margins through hands-on operational work.
That hands-on approach seems absolutely critical now. We saw Justin McGorman at Reveal Business, for example. They specialize in driving growth for PE firms precisely by unlocking hidden value through that kind of direct operational transformation.
And they're seeing results.
Yeah, he mentioned often yielding a really significant 10 to 15 times return on their services.
Wow. And Wambu Amutua's analysis really underlines why this is so crucial. He noted that you often need something like a 15% EBITDA compound annual growth rate just to hit those 25% IRR targets.
15% CAGR. That's a high bar.
It is. And it fundamentally changes the investment math. Firms just can't rely solely on leverage anymore, not with rates where they are. They have to achieve serious operational growth. That makes this corporate craftsmanship not just nice to have, but essential.
And Zorian Rotenberg shared similar insights, right? From Todd Abrecht at THL Partners and backed by a Goldman Sachs study.
Exactly. Confirming that PE has really shifted. It used to be about the leverage and the buyout. Now it demands significant operational value after the deal closes. Growth is undeniably the main driver now.
So how are firms actually executing this? Philip Kraft had a fascinating, almost cautionary statistic on that.
Oh, yeah.
He found that treating value creation like some kind of hero-led individual effort only results in about 72% completion.
Only 72%. So relying on one star performer isn't enough.
Apparently not. It really highlights the need for a more systemic, structured approach. He gave examples where proper structural design cut delivery time by 41% and unlocked $2.5 million in value. Mm. It shows the power of process.
That's a stark reminder. Process over lone heroes. Dinesh Vasundhani offered some very down-to-earth advice on this, didn't he?
Yeah, he suggested the fastest way to create value is basically applying Toyota Production System thinking, TPS.
Lean principles, essentially.
Right. Fundamental blocking and tackling. Fixing obvious waste, like optimizing sales comp, getting disciplined about factory ops, smart purchasing, the basics done really well.
And David Mackey added a great rule for PE-backed CTOs, buy for speed, build for differentiation.
Explain that a bit.
His point is, if a tech solution doesn't give you a unique competitive edge, don't waste time and money building it in-house. The hidden costs and delays just aren't worth it. Buy off the shelf for speed, save your building efforts for what truly differentiates you.
That makes a lot of sense. Focus your resources. And Alexis Chevalier stressed the importance of integration in European M&A.
Yeah, the pre- and post-merger phases.
Exactly. He argues value is really created or destroyed in those critical months before and after the deal closes. It's not just about the boardroom decisions. It's about nailing the execution during those transitions.
Scott Bingham's view reinforces that. He said, the current market, longer hold periods, higher rates, it demands this balanced approach. You need operational rigor, sustainable growth strategies, and smart use of tech.
And looking long term, Aaron Harrison's finding was interesting. PE firms have significantly outperformed the Russell 3000 over 25 years.
What did he attribute that to?
Partly to disciplined practices like zero-based budgeting. That discipline where every single expense has to be justified from scratch each period really drives efficiency.
But there's still room to improve, right? Eva Garcia de la Fuente's EY study on exit readiness pointed that out.
Yeah, it found value creation plans often need better translation into measurable financial impact. Data quality is frequently lacking. Something like 72% of firms don't have reliable data, and management teams often not adequately prepped for the exit process.
Which connects nicely to what Jeff Schwartz noted. He sees PE firms shifting towards longer-term value creation and adopting structured plans like A&M's Rapid Portfolio Exit Readiness.
Integrating operational improvements and AI to maximize that final exit value.
Exactly. And Dr. Mark P. Bielitsa discussed how firms are constantly tweaking their value creation capabilities. Some build in-house teams like KKR. Others rely on external partners like EQT or use a hybrid model. That adaptability is becoming key for staying competitive.
And finally, Athena's Vale has brought it back to AI again, stressing that the real value comes from building practical, integrated systems that genuinely enhance decision-making and diligence, performance tracking, process optimization, all guided by a clear strategy.
So wrapping up value creation, the message is loud and clear, isn't it? It's moved way beyond financial engineering. It's a deep shift towards hands-on operational transformation, structured growth. Firms are embracing corporate craftsmanship to drive real, measurable EBITDA gains. They know sustainable value is built inside the portfolio companies, often boosted by better data tools and strong operational processes.
Okay, moving to our next vital area. Talent, leadership, and organizational structure. The people behind the gains. It feels like the human element is getting much more recognition as central to PE success.
Absolutely. Emmer Gould's perspective was really clear on this. PE success is fundamentally about people, not just slashing costs. She sees HR playing a really crucial strategic role now.
In what ways?
Shaping business models, building those high-performance cultures, and critically, closing leadership gaps within the portfolio companies. It's becoming much more strategic.
And Kip Knipple had that powerful line, money talks, but leadership walks.
Yeah, what was his point there?
He argues that the top PE firms win because they have leadership readiness. They've built a deep bench of pre-vetted talent ready to step into portfolio companies before a deal even closes. This avoids costly delays and gives them a real competitive edge.
Having talent ready to deploy immediately, that makes sense. But what's really fascinating is Merritt McKenzie's research. It actually showed that appointing first-time CEOs in PE-backed firms can maximize returns.
Really? First-time CEOs? That seems counterintuitive.
It does, but the data suggests they often deliver higher ROI and are more likely to lead bold, transformative change. Apparently, operational excellence often trumps prior CEO experience in this context. Challenges some old assumptions, right?
Definitely does. But on the flip side, Maxwell Salazar observed that too many leadership hires in PE tend to fail quietly.
Fail quietly, meaning they underperform but aren't necessarily fired quickly?
Exactly. Which underscores the need for really rigorous talent assessment strategies. He argues firms need to go way beyond just superficial psychometric tests or relying on search firms who are mainly focused on making the placement. It's about finding the right fit for the unique demands of a PE environment.
And this brings up the importance of specialized roles. Trevor Scott and Scott A. Scanlon highlighted the critical role of the Chief Transformation Officer, the CTRO.
How impactful is that role?
Well, they found that when a CTRO is embedded from year one, they can speed up the execution of the value creation plan by something like 25-40% and potentially improve ROI by 15-25%.
That's a huge measurable impact from one role.
It really is. And Andy Sharma also pointed to the changing role of the CIO, the Chief Information Officer. They're now seen as critical players in the PE value chain.
Driving digital alpha, he called it.
Yeah, through strategic tech due diligence, modernizing infrastructure, strengthening cybersecurity, all essential for growth and resilience today.
And Joe Ciantonis's data from H1 2025 backs this up, showing where interim projects are focusing in PE.
What are the hotspots?
Things like transformation offices, go-to-market strategies, data and AI initiatives, and strategic finance. It really reflects how these operational roles are evolving to unlock value.
Okay, so summing up talent and leadership, it feels like a major strategic pivot, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's clearly not just about financial restructuring anymore. It's about actively building, assessing, and deploying the right human capital from the C-suite down to those specialized transformation roles.
It seems the best PE firms really get that investing in people and having structured talent strategies is just as critical as investing in the businesses themselves.
Right. Now let's turn to finance leadership, CFO, governance, and boards driving accountability. These are the structures that really ensure firms deliver.
John Forrestal has done some interesting work here, identifying the key traits needed for high-performing PE CFOs, especially when things get complex. It's really about shifting from just accounting to being a strategic financial partner.
And Peter Walichek, on his podcast, really hammered home the CFO's role in portfolio companies for achieving successful exits.
What was his key message?
He stressed that structure is the prerequisite for every exit. And he highlighted the importance of tracking the right KPIs right from the first 100 days. It's about building that exit-ready discipline from the start.
That makes sense. And Desmond Wong reinforced the idea that strong cash performance discipline is more vital than ever right now.
Especially with the current economic climate.
Exactly. With higher rates, managing cash effectively isn't just important, it's foundational for value creation and resilience.
Krista Crawford and Alex Pananas brought up a really interesting point, drawing on McKinsey research.
What was that?
About how public company boards are actually starting to adopt PE operating practices.
Oh, really?
How so?
They found boards are shifting focus from pure compliance towards more active strategic stewardship. They're concentrating more on impact, engaging directly with stakeholders, and focusing explicitly on value creation. It shows the PE playbook is influencing broader corporate governance.
That is interesting. And Alan Gonsenhauser had a strong message for marketing teams too, didn't he?
Yeah, about metrics. He argued they need to shift away from vanity metrics. Things like impressions, clicks, likes.
Right, the stuff that looks good, but might not drive real value.
Exactly. And move towards value metrics. Things like customer lifetime value, reliable revenue growth, lower PAC payback periods. Metrics that clearly demonstrate cash flow impact and earn marketing a seat at the boardroom table. It's about speaking the language of finance and value.
So the core message on finance and governance seems to be a push towards greater accountability and more strategic financial management overall.
Definitely. CFOs are becoming even more central, especially in driving exit readiness. And even public boards are borrowing from PE's intense focus on measurable value creation. It's all about tightening controls and ensuring every part of the organization contributes directly to that bottom line.
Okay, let's zoom out a bit now to market trends and fundraising navigating the capital landscape. What's the big picture? Where's the money flowing?
Well, John Yagnoli shared a pretty staggering number. PE firms globally raised over $2 trillion between 2020 and 2024.
$2 trillion. Wow.
Yeah, it paints a vivid picture of capital flows, shifting geographies, and evolving investment ideas, even with all the recent market ups and downs.
And Sam Tidswell-Norrish highlighted that massive $84 trillion intergenerational wealth transfer that's expected.
Right, positioning private markets for potentially huge new inflows.
Exactly. He noted that while, 94% of wealth managers already allocate something to PE, there are still real opportunities, particularly in the lower middle market.
Why there specifically?
For finding mispriced assets and generating that operational alpha we talked about, but without getting into those massive bidding wars you see with the mega funds, it suggests the sweet spot might be smaller deals right now.
That makes sense. Find value where others aren't looking as hard. And speaking of mega funds, Kazar Narimanli found that KKR is way out ahead in global fundraising.
How far ahead?
They pulled in a staggering $117.9 billion just between 2020 and 2024. It really shows their unmatched capital raising clout and their influence on global deals. They're in a league of their own there.
On a different note, Paul Press gave an update on GP-led secondaries. Those transactions where a GP sells an asset from one fund to a new vehicle, they also manage.
Yeah, becoming more common, right?
Interest is definitely rising, he said. Optimism is ticking up. But the actual execution volume is still lagging a bit. Seems there are still some hurdles around pricing and the quality of the process itself.
And Vincent Schneider shared an interesting observation. Despite signs of market recovery, most big PE investors haven't actually returned to their 2021 deal-making frenzy levels.
Oh, So Activia is still subdued.
For many, yes. Only a handful, he mentioned firms like CVC, KKR, EQT, seem to be maintaining similar activity levels. It suggests a generally more cautious, selective approach across the board right now.
We also saw Marco Masotti release his annual report on PE fundraising trends, and Daniel Kemp interviewed Chloe Brain from Colonial First State about increasing their exposure to private markets now.
So continued appetite, but maybe more selective deployment.
Seems like it. And finally, we saw comprehensive market updates from CBIZ via Megan O'Drain and KPMG via Lauren Iremera. Both are consistently tracking how AI is influencing strategy, talent, portfolio steering, providing valuable ongoing market intel.
Okay, so summing up market trends and fundraising.
Yeah.
It's definitely dynamic. Huge amounts of capital have been raised, but the market isn't monolithic.
Right.
While the giants like KKR continue to dominate fundraising, the actual deal-making seems more cautious, and maybe the best opportunities for operational value are shifting towards that lower middle market, away from the fiercest competition.
Makes sense. Now, for a quick look at sector and geography signals where the action is, any specific areas getting attention?
Well, Maurizio Paolella gave a neat example of infrastructure momentum. He pointed to the Strait of Messina Bridge project in Italy.
The big bridge project.
Yeah, apparently it's drawing significant private equity investment into southern Italy. A good example of PE targeting large-scale infra opportunities.
And Marshall Smith had an interesting take on why PE is loving wealth tech SaaS right now.
What was his angle? He argued it's not just about buying cool tech. It's about buying distribution that AI can't kill overnight. He points to the AUM-based billing model used by trusted financial advisors. He calls it a Fort Knox of recurring revenue that's really hard for AI on its own to disrupt quickly. So it's buying stability and sticky customer relationships.
That's a clever way to frame it. And geographically, Hugh MacArthur, referencing Bain & Co.'s Jim Verbeaten, mentioned Japan remains attractive for PE.
Why Japan?
Largely due to a big pool of potential target companies and maybe increasingly more scrutiny being placed on investments in China, making Japan look relatively more appealing.
Okay. On a more critical note, though, Matt Bowers voiced some real concerns about PE's impact in the automotive retail sector.
What were his concerns?
He basically suggested PE ownership has often made the business worse, limiting ownership opportunities for others and being driven purely by financial motives without enough respect for the actual industry. It raises questions about PE's long-term impact beyond just returns.
That's an important counterpoint. And finally, Morel Fernandez-Mendoza updated us on that massive, record-breaking $6.1 billion sale of the Boston Celtics to a PE mogul.
Right, the sports ownership trend.
Exactly. It sparked wider questions about PE taking stakes in professional sports teams. What do you think that means for the future of sports?
It's definitely something to watch. I mean, on one hand, PE brings capital, operational discipline, potentially professionalizing things. But on the other hand, like Matt Bowers hinted, that primary financial driver could clash with the, you know, cultural or community aspects that are so important in sports. It's a balancing act.
Definitely one to keep an eye on. Okay, before we wrap up, let's quickly touch on products, partnerships, and Insight highlights new tools for the PE playbook. Always good to see what innovations are popping up.
Taylor Lowe announced Metal's new institutional intelligence platform designed for PE. It aims to create what they call fund DNA.
Fund DNA.
Yeah, by connecting all the scattered data fund info, deal history, investment logic, the goal is to help firms build a more repeatable competitive edge by leveraging their own institutional knowledge better.
Making sense of their own data chaos, essentially. And Alessandro Rochella shared his proprietary database.
The one covering European portfolio companies.
That's the one. Over 5,000 companies across European regions. It's designed specifically to help PE funds find suitable investment targets, and especially to identify smaller add-on acquisitions to grow their existing platform companies, streamlining deal sourcing.
Okay, so looking at these new tools and partnerships, the trend seems pretty clear.
What's that?
Technology and specialized data are really enabling PE firms to be sharper, more data-driven, and more efficient right across the investment lifecycle. It's all about using information better for smarter decisions and faster growth.
Makes sense. Well, that covers the key themes we saw bubbling up on LinkedIn in weeks 32 and 33. If you enjoyed this deep dive, new deep dives drop every 2 weeks. Also, be sure to check out our other editions covering venture capital, M&A, and strategy and consulting.
And as we leave you, here's something to think about. As private equity continues to adapt to higher interest rates, to more sophisticated AI integration, to these evolving talent demands, What single aspect of this whole transformation do you think will have the most profound, the most lasting impact on the industry over the next 5 years?
A great question to ponder. Thanks so much for joining us on this deep dive. Don't forget to subscribe so you catch our future explorations.